And now, the Low Post.
Welcome to a Friday hotel room edition of the Low Post podcast live from an undisclosed location in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania with the great Dave McMenamin. How are you?
I'm great, Zach. Thanks for having me.
When is your interview for the Lakers coaching job?
Why not? Let's throw my hat in the ring. It would give me a little bit of a raise from what ESPN's paying.
Apparently, all you have to do is win over Kurt Rambis.
That's the guy, right?
Which is the if you had told me a year ago that Markelle Fultz would not be playing, I'd be like, fine, makes sense. It was like crazy rookie season. I get it. That Brian Colangelo would have to resign in semi-disgrace because of a Twitter scandal, I would have been like, that's pretty weird. And then you said, by the way, Kurt Rambis is going to be controlling the Lakers coaching search, at least in part because his wife is Jeannie Buss's best friend. I would have been like, that's where I draw the line. That's too ridiculous to possibly be true.
Not plausible.
Implausible.
It's wild. And listen, it's tough because I think sometimes when there's a lack of information that we fill in the gaps a little bit with an assumed negative perception. And I'm not trying to just protect Linda and Kurt, but they have become the new punching bags when it comes to the Lakers dysfunction.
But it's true.
But isn't it more Jeannie Buss?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. The buck stops there, right. For sure. Absolutely, for sure. But it's true that he has risen to a powerful position. It was like the land speed record for the transition from, oh, that's right, Kurt Rambis works for the Lakers in some capacity, to Kurt Rambis is a powerful presence. It just happened, like, overnight.
Yeah. And so, you know, obviously the regular season was a tough one for them. And it was notable that right around the All-Star break, he started coming on road trips. And we're all like, that's interesting, you know. But he kind of keeps to himself. And it wasn't like you saw him necessarily interacting a lot with the coaches or being on the court with the players during shoot-arounds or anything like that. He'd usually be in the stands or, you know, on his phone or whatever. And you wondered if he was just eyes and ears for Magic because he has such a long-standing relationship with Magic. But then when Magic leaves, then it seems like Kurt's risen only more. So it's the Lakers.
And you said it was unclear if he was interacting with the coaches. Interaction is a good word in Lakerdom right now because there is not much between people who really need to be interacting. Yeah. And there are people who are in that organization who are powerful who learn about things on Twitter. Like that Ty Lue is maybe not going to be the coach. And it's like, that's just not how good organizations operate.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Like, there was a wave of goodwill, I guess, that occurred back in February 2017 when Magic comes in and the subsequent hiring of Rob Pelinka, where they're like, okay, things got sideways and let's get everybody on the same page. And it lasted a little bit and then it wore off. Then Magic leaves and the organization tries to do the same thing again. And all of a sudden you have coaching interviews where about 7 or 8 people in the organization are involved, where they get one-on-one time with the candidate.
Which seemed for a second like, all right, okay, they figured out a good way to make decisions. And then that didn't last past the interviews.
Absolutely. So then you wonder, what was the motivation to do that? Was it just because some of the people involved in those interviews actually have a good public perception right now? So the people with a bad public perception are using them as pawns to be involved in the interview process to get the fans' heat off of them? Because if they're not going to listen to whatever feedback those other people have from being involved in the interview process and apply it, or they're not going to involve them in the subsequent steps that happen after the interview, then to me it's window dressing, and that's disappointing, and that's why I point right up to the top back to Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka.
This has been a really tough playoffs for you. You're on the Sixers beat. Yeah. The Sixers are always fun. They're always fun. There's always stuff going on. Mm-hmm. They're now going to a Game 7, which we are going to start talking about. And meanwhile, your regular beat is a 3-ring circus.
Yeah.
And you're juggling, and it's on the opposite coast. It's not been an easy playoffs for Dave McMahon. I just had a great idea. I don't know if the New York Times still does this, but remember they did a thing where they would just basically take two interesting people and have them have a conversation, and like that would be a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like it would, they would publish it on video and a Q&A. Like Hillary Clinton, I think, did one with somebody. I can't remember. I think Rob Pelinka and Kyrie Irving, if it were not tampering, that's what I want to see.
Would be wonderful.
Rob Pelinka would make some extended metaphor about like jungle animals, and Kyrie Irving would be like, but aren't we animals too? What is the difference between us and animals? What is anything really? Yeah. And it would just go off the rails immediately. It wouldn't even ever be on the rails. It would just be wild.
It would be just out in the ether. But it would be, that'd be like the way aliens would land on our planet. Like, you know, they've been putting out signals for like years and years and years, like just in case there's radio waves out in space that some other life form can pick up on it. Somehow that conversation would be the portal into some other alien life form coming down. And
hey, look, I've always said I will watch almost any alien invasion movie. I don't watch really any movies anymore, but I love it. I'm a sucker for alien invasion movies. I have always said if they come, I want it to be during my lifetime. Even if they just eliminated us immediately with like giant laser beams that we can't defend against, I want to be a part of it.
But what if you didn't get to see them though? What if they just had some detonator and you just die and you don't even know that it was because of aliens? You would need them to come and like kind of take over the airwaves or whatever media.
Yeah, I want to be watching TV like happens in all the movies where all of a sudden it's like, here's this unidentified flying object. What's going on? There's one in Brazil. There's one in China. There's one in the. I want to have that moment.
Yeah.
And I want to go in the basement and be like, now we're holding up in the basement. Right. Let's see if we can outlast it. I just want the whole thing.
Who's it? Judd Hirsch? Is that the actor in Independence Day? Who's kind of like the guy who's the in the basement guy?
Is Judd Hirsch the Dear John?
Yeah.
He might be. It might be him. It's been a while since I've seen 1996's Independence Day. okay, enough. The Sixers are playing Game 7 in Toronto on Sunday. Game 7, two sweetest words in sports. Mm-hmm. We got two. I think we're going to get three. I think Houston is going to win tonight, which means it's just a jamboree on Sunday. Kevin Arnovitz wrote a very nice story on Game 6, which we were all at last night, mm-hmm. about if there were game sevens are fun because it's like the terms of engagement are set. There's no more surprises now. All the adjustments have been made, but Philly pretty late in the game made a semi adjustment last night where they were like, hey, Kawhi, we're just throwing everybody at you. We're throwing everybody at you. We're throwing two guys at you. We're going to shade a third guy at you and we're going to make all these other dudes make threes. And Marc Gasol had another game where he was like, oh, I got to shoot. Oh, but I don't want to shoot. I like to pass. And like, so like, let me find this ideal optimal thing. And then he missed every shot. And when they play, one of the downsides of playing Ibaka more, and particularly Ibaka and Siakam together, is that their shooting quotient goes down. And you could see that Philly was more aggressive double teaming when the Siakam Ibaka combination, was on the floor. And I assume they will do that again. A lot of these games just come down to it's. I don't know what was Toronto last night from three. It was very, very bad. 9 of 36.
Yeah.
9 of 36, you lose. 14 of 36, you win. Sometimes that's all it is.
In open threes, in their losses in the series coming into yesterday, they were shooting like 20% on open threes. So that's kind of was the story, and not getting. Back the Lakers talk, but that was the story of the Lakers season to some extent. Not as sexy as, you know, LeBron James wanting Anthony Davis and hurting the chemistry of the locker room, but it was, they missed open threes like all year long, and it's a death knell for a team.
It turns out I don't want to cause any controversy here. It turns out when you sign bad shooters, they're gonna miss a lot of shots. I didn't know that. I'm as surprised as you. You want to hear a fun stat from the series?
I'd love it.
The total score of Toronto-Philadelphia through six games is Toronto by 17. Okay, so about 3 points a game. Joel Embiid in 192 minutes in a series in which his team has been outscored by 17 points is plus 80.
Wow.
Which means that in the remaining 96 minutes in my sleep-deprived brain, I hope I did the math right, 96 non-Joel Embiid minutes. The Sixers are minus 97.
Nice.
That's like not even possible.
And that's when you hear Brett Brown almost pleading to the media, like, do you got any suggestions for the eighth man after game six? Because their bench is just not up to snuff. And I've enjoyed the contributions that James Ennis has given.
He's been huge.
And since Mike Scott came back from his injury, he's been pretty reliable. But, you know, and Boban actually gave them good minutes in the first round against Brooklyn. Like, let's not pretend that he hasn't been part of this playoff run, but he was a minus 15 in 4 minutes in game six.
It was bad. It was bad. And they cut it to 42-25. And it's just like these games have these moments where Toronto cuts whatever it was, 15-7. And timeout. Okay, Boban, that's enough. We've seen enough out of you. Jimmy, you got to come back in the game. They come out. They have like a kind of a weird possession that doesn't go very well. Jimmy gets the ball kicked to him, pump fake, makes like a 17-foot leaner that goes in. They're back up by 9. I just feel like Jimmy, every time the game was like maybe going to get close, somebody on Toronto missed, and then Jimmy Butler made a play. And the last 2 minutes of the second quarter was, I think, considering the importance of the game, I think it was the best moments of Jimmy Butler's career. He had that insane play where he missed a three. The rebound came crazily to him, and he banked in an and one. Yeah. Then he made a floater. Then with 10 seconds left, he poked the ball away from Kawhi and made a coast-to-coast layup, and the whole crowd was chanting Jimmy Butler. And it was actually very cool. They walked off to the locker room, and the chant continued, even though nobody was on the floor. I thought Jimmy and Philly, I think, have proven a very nice match.
Yeah, and on the end one, I mean, he was playing to the crowd. He had his hands up, and he was like, let me hear it. And it was, you know, for a kid who grew up in the Philly suburbs like myself, it was like an Iverson moment, and the fans were eating it up. And I guess we can just stay on game seven. We can stay on game six. But the question is, will he still be around to get that adulation from the Philly faithful this summer and beyond?
Well, I think the other big development of last night's game, which screwed me a little bit because I had a column about this, was that Ben Simmons showed up. And sometimes Ben Simmons showing up is just a matter of like, in the first 4 minutes of the game, does he get a couple chances to push off a miss or a turnover? And he did. And I just feel like it gets him a little bit spicier. And that for whatever reason last night, and this is the column that I'm now kind of rewriting a little bit, but he spent most of this series just sitting down in the dunker spot below the rim, kind of not really involved. And it's been, I think, a simmering issue that is on the verge of becoming maybe a little bit more than that. And Jimmy Butler has been the point guard of the team. But last night they found ways to get Ben the ball in open space, even in the half court. He ran more pick and roll here and pick and roll with Embiid. He kind of got rumbling to the basket. And when that guy shows up, they're a different team. And they found the right balance of Jimmy doing his thing and Ben doing his thing and everybody kind of meshing. It wasn't as good as game three, which I thought was the best game this team has played, period. But, you know, again, like if Ben Simmons scores 9 points on 4 of 10, they're going to lose. If he scores 16 points and gets a few putback dunks and whatever, they might win.
Yeah, and JJ Redick, such an eloquent guy, and he tried to explain like what the Sixers are about earlier in the playoffs. And you could say this is a split personality team. These are my words now, not his. He's more eloquent. But, or you could say it's a team that has the ability to play all different sorts of style. And so, yeah, you can give it to Embiid, and he's the biggest force that the league has in terms of sheer size. Yet, he is not ideal to be paired with a guy who has some of the best open court instincts outside of LeBron and Ben Simmons. And you can run all sorts of misdirection and action for a guy like JJ to get open for catch and shoot opportunities. But that kind of takes Jimmy out of his game a little bit, because Jimmy likes to kind of probe and have the ball in his hands. Yet at the same time, if you need a guy to probe and have his ball in his hands, you're Jimmy Butler. So it's like you have these disparate parts that actually, if you can distill it and go to the different parts when you need it and want it, and everybody's okay with it, I mean, that's the tough part. If everyone buys in, they just don't feel useless, because Ben Simmons at times looked useless in the series.
He did. Yeah, not useless. I get what you're saying, because in the half court, he just wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. He was in the way. And he found a way to be less in the way, but also when he was in that spot, like they call it the dunker spot. Yep. He got a dunk out of that. He got like three dunks out of that spot. They call it the dunker spot because it's the dunker spot. I mean, and part of this, as you said, is like, this is how you win a championship. If you want to win a championship, you got to get a lot of good players together, and some of them are going to have to sacrifice some stuff. Like, that's tough. And Brett, you know, I remember I did a story in January on them. This is before they got Harris even. Mm-hmm. And Brett said two things that you just hit on. Number one, I'm aware that the game can outrun Joel, and we've tried to tell Ben it's not a 100-meter dash. Like, you can't just run past our big guy. And number two, said, I keep telling him, and this is where the Spurs thing comes in. He says, like, you don't get to win championships on your own terms. You just don't get to. And, or maybe one guy does. You know, Tim Duncan does. And, yeah. And, you know, and Tim Duncan doesn't even care about his terms because he's Tim Duncan. And by the way, that's another subplot of all this. Nobody really knows if Brett Brown is for sure coming back to coach this team next year. And I will say this. If that ownership group is like judging him based on whether they win or lose game seven, that's insane. You either want him as your coach or you don't. And I'm I think he's actually done a very nice job in this series. And again, this is a tricky group. Joel has been sick. His knee is up and down, whatever. Simmons is the trickiest piece in the whole league. And like, here they are, 3-3 against a team that I think is qualitatively a little better than them. His adjustments in game two changed the series. And they're playing hard. They're playing together. Like, I think Brett has done a really good job in this series.
I think he has as well. And whether you want to give this as much weight, and maybe you shouldn't, because coach speak is less valuable than coaches executing moves. But the playoffs kind of began for them with that halftime speech of game two after they had lost game one to Brooklyn, and game two wasn't looking so great. And apparently Brett got into the guys, and they have this historic third quarter, score 51 points, whatever it was, in the the third quarter of game two against Brooklyn. And that's kind of the start of their ascension. And everyone, almost to a man in that locker room, credited Brett for like knowing the room and choosing the right moment. And you know, listen, he's been through a whole lot of stuff in 6 years.
If he writes I should be lobbying him to ghostwrite his book.
So
I'm sure I'm 10th on the list.
I'm probably, and I'm sure I wouldn't be on the list, but I'm probably maybe taking some liberties with a, you know, background conversation I had with him. But he told me last week, like, man, I could write a book. he's very aware.
I would buy it immediately and read it. And if it were 100% candid, it would be like better than the Phil Jackson books where he roasted Kobe and like told a lot of stories. Yeah. I think Brett's done a good job, and this has been a really interesting series. Give me one thing you're looking at. Well, you know what? You mentioned game two. I want to go back. Mentioned game two, Brooklyn, but it reminded me game two. Game two of this series was, I think, the strangest game of the series. It was like that rock fight that was 90-something, 80-something. And I have a feeling that if Philly wins, it's going to look like that. Because this series, finally over six games, I remember previewing it with David Thorpe, which seems like 4 months ago. I said, after watching film, I think this could kind of be a physical defensive series. And sometimes it looked like that and sometimes it didn't. After six games, it's Toronto 107 points per 100 possessions, Philly 104, both of which are below average to bottom for the NBA season. And so it's kind of ended up looking like that. And I just think if Philly wins on the road in game seven, it's going to look like game two, where it's just a grind and it's ugly and they pound the glass and it's just a bloodbath.
But in that game two, and this is maybe like where, you know, the things that grab our attention, like, you know, defense, I'm almost on the Jabari Parker thing. It's hard for defense to get me excited. Jimmy Butler, though, was making big shots, you know, and he hits that three and Embiid kicks out to him, takes their lead from 4-7 in a moment where Toronto is making a charge. And then, of course, which could be if Philly does get to the conference finals or beyond, that spin move and step through that Joel had late in that game.
The biggest shot of his career.
And so can you just get the big buckets on the road if it is a grind out type of situation, and whether that will be from their stars or they're going to need it. But, you know, Mike Scott looked really in a nice rhythm in Game Six. Can he bring that on the road?
Oh, you mentioned. This is why I like how you're pinging my brain to yeah. Mike Scott. So the eighth man thing, mm-hmm. they can't figure out who it is.
Yeah.
So they last night again kind of flirted with Mike Scott at center.
Yes.
Or you could call Ben Simmons the center. Those lineups are in very limited minutes getting destroyed. They're minus 16 in 9 minutes with Mike Scott at center.
Okay.
I just still wonder if that's ultimately the best answer to that question, even though the numbers in a tiny sample size, which is irrelevant, are not good. I don't think it's Boban. I don't think it's Amir Johnson. I don't think it's Jonathan Simmons. I
don't think it's Greg Monroe. Even though he had Greg some
Monroe,
moments.
You know what? That's the other answer, is that Greg Monroe had a very nice stretch of a couple games early in the series and has since vanished. It's clearly not going to be TJ McConnell, no matter how much the fans agitate for it here. Or maybe it will be. Maybe Brett will surprise us. Those lineups haven't been good. Defensively, they are very challenged. Kawhi just finds Mike Scott and has his guy set a screen and then roasts Mike Scott on a switch. So I get it. But, you know, Simmons at center, if you want to call him the center in those lineups, has always been like, it's like the Giannis at center thing. It's always been the thing that's like, why don't they try that a little more when Joel needs a rest?
Yeah, I think, well, one, he is at the either going to cross match when you get, you know, back on defense or whatever. Because, I mean, he does guard the best wing sometimes, and then so that you're creating that. Or like, then if he's going to go off one of the guards, you got to make sure you have the right guard lineup in there, because, you know, what if JJ's still out there and he's left to take on a guy who's a legitimate offensive yeah. player? I would explain that, but basically when I had spoke to someone on the Sixers staff or in the first round about, like, could we see more Ben at center? It was all about, that helps us in one area, but then what about what happens to our defense at the top line?
But I'm glad you mentioned transition defense, because I think when Toronto has had bad moments in this series, it's because their transition defense has slipped a little bit last night, and particularly last night on Redick on a couple of his threes. And this is a series, anytime, again, Philly's a weird roster. There's always tons of cross-matching in Philly games because of how big and strange they are. And I think this is a series where in transition, you cannot be picky. You cannot be like, well, I'm supposed to be guarding that guy, but there's a cross-match. Let me find that guy. Then all of a sudden, JJ Redick has just run by two guys who are like, well, he's not my assignment. I'll let someone else. And no one picked him up. And the team that has won the transition defense battle is the team that has been less picky. And I think Toronto has flirted with being too picky too many times, and it's burned them. And that's this is all these little games within the game. But back to Mike Scott and Kawhi and Kawhi toasting him. Kawhi's playmaking is always an X factor to me. And I think he has 25 assists in six games, so about four assists a game. Look, it's worked. He's had an incredible series. I thought he forced some shots last night when they were swarming him and other guys were open, and maybe he doesn't trust those guys. I get it. But I also think it's one of the reasons, like, I'm very surprised that Toronto has not done a better job really going at Redick the way Brooklyn did. And having his guy screen for Kyle, having his guy screen for Kawhi. You know, they do it. They do it 5-6 times a game. It frequently doesn't work very well. And I think part of the reason is, like, Kawhi and Danny Green, even though they're teammates for a long time now, there's just something that's not working. Like, JJ is able to hedge that and get back to Danny Green yeah. without any openings popping up. And it's just been weird to me. And I just wonder if they just, that's where Kawhi's just so feel as a playmaker is kind of hurting them, because they haven't been able to exploit that. And I've been very surprised.
And you saw, I think it was game two, the grindout game you were mentioning, that where JJ did get kind of isolated on Danny on a couple of possessions, and it got kind of physical, and JJ got popped in the head and blood on the
yeah,
floor
that's right.
and everything like that. And that was like they were basically posting up a deep post Danny on JJ, and JJ had kind of no recourse but to just claw and scrape and grab him. That's the type of matchup that in almost any playoff series, you usually see the other team do a heavy diet of just, okay, we're going to find that mismatch and exploit until you have to take him out of the game. And I guess either credit for JJ
doing fights.
Some things.
He knows
yeah.
the scheme. He's always going to fight.
Right. and or maybe a little bit of, you know, Nick Nurse. Maybe that's something you look at.
Well, the way to do it is not Danny Green posting up. As charming as Danny Green's post-up game is, the slowest post-up game in the league, I don't think that's how you do it. And the other thing, I wonder about this. If they start swarming Kawhi again and you miss 2, 3, 4 threes in a row out of it, because, like, Ibaka doesn't want to shoot threes. You can see he doesn't even want to shoot long twos sometimes, although he had a nice game. Games 4 and 5, he had a nice stretch of long twos. Mark... This is just off and on. It's just off and on.
Push shot too, and it's almost like it's like the release is almost a hesitation of okay, we got to do this.
Kyle is, you know, you just don't know what Kyle is showing up on a particular.
Like, he was hunting shots in Game 4.
Yeah,
that probably made the only game of the series where I looked at him hunting shots.
I thought he was great in 5. I think he had 19, 6, and 6 or something in 5, which is what you need out of him. And last night he ended up with 13, but it just didn't feel like he was in the game.
Yeah.
I wonder if you start mixing in some cutting instead of just waiting for Kawhi to kick the ball out, because they didn't do enough of that last night, and Siakam got a bucket at the rim. If you remember when they doubled Kawhi, he kicked to Mark, and then Mark threw a straight top of the key pass to Pascal under the rim. I don't know if Philly is going to be ready for, like, Toronto to cut around. I just think that's a little something.
If Joel's right, though, I mean, obviously you can only be in the lane for 2.9 seconds, but if Joel's right, you can try to pull him out with Mark or whatever, but he'll be down there, right? And I mean, active, and you're cutting towards a 7'3", 290 guy.
He had a couple of monster blocks on that kind of action last night. And again, it's dumb, but you heard the plus minus numbers. Like, when Joel plays well, they win.
That's what it is.
And they won one game, game two, when he was 2 of 7, I think, when he didn't play well. But when he doesn't play well, or he was sick or whatever, they don't win. You know, and so, I've also been surprised Mark has been able to do no damage in the post against Tobias Harris. I thought when they made that switch, that would be an area where Toronto would look for, because these are playoff, they're grinded out games. Like, sometimes you got to just play that way, even though I don't think Nick Nurse wants to play post-up basketball, but, like, sometimes you got to play it. He's posted up 17 times in the series, according to Second Spectrum, 0.78 points per post-up when he finishes the play. It's a little better than that when you include the whole possession, but it's not very good. I guess that's just not going to work.
What's the standard that you're looking for on a what's a good post up point?
Good post up guy against a mismatch a mismatch. You can, in a short series, if he's rolling, you can get 1.2. You can get pretty fat numbers, and like 1.0 flat for, like, over a season is pretty good, because post ups are hard. 1.1 is, like, really hard to get to, really, but
that's just not there, right? What have you thought of Tobias this series? To me, it's going to sound simplified, but when his shot's falling, he looks like a pretty effective player. When it's not, he looks like just like an average, very average player.
He's 10 of 38 on threes in the series. So that's 28% or 26% or whatever it is. Averaging 14 a game. That's not good enough. Again, Toronto is so this is the numbers in these series, in series, short series, are so funny. So Toronto's plus 17 for the series. Both starting lineups are plus. Philly starters are plus 16. Toronto starters are plus 24. Joel Embiid is plus 9,000. Tobias Harris is somehow minus 34, and he's been stuck with the Boban lineups and stuck. It's not his fault, but those bench lineups, when he's out there without Butler, because Butler's plus something, okay, and those lineups aren't working. So it's not all his fault, but he has not been able to step into a more dominant role when he's been given the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, and you've seen, like, he has that catch and shoot game that from the wing on down to the wing. Excuse me, the wing on down to the corner, it just looks right. His shot usually is coming off his hand the right way. And then he has this pull-up long two game where it's a feathery jump shot, but it just something about the way he shoots, the trajectory, you almost know right away whether it's going in or not.
I agree. It's funny. I look at him in midair. I'm like, ooh, that's not.
Yeah.
It's game seven is going to be awesome. And you know, the teams know each other now. It's just going to be a matter of who makes shots, who makes hustle plays. And that's why game sevens are so awesome. I have a very important question for you.
Mm-hmm.
As a Philly native, do you count as a Philly native, suburban Philly? Do people count that?
I mean, I do.
It's controversial. It's a source of controversy.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure people in West Philadelphia would be like, Radner, are you kidding me? But, I mean, Kobe claimed Philly. It's my high school.
It's funny. My sister-in-law lives in Haverford.
Yes.
And so when we take the kids there, when we visit, we go playgrounds on the weekends when the weather is nice. And there was one we go to. I think her son has a soccer games in Lower Merion.
Oh, sure.
And when I first saw the name Lower Merion, I was like, I almost was like, oh, this is like a famous, it's like famous. This is where Kobe is from. There should be a sign that's like Kobe Bryant is from here.
So guess what? Like, I actually may pitch this to our editors at some point. There's buses of visitors that come every summer. Cause like, so King of Prussia Mall is like this really popular mall, one of the biggest ones in the country. And people come from out of the country to visit that mall, like people from, you know, like China and you know, Japan, whatever, other European countries as well. But in particular, like some buddies with one of the assistant coaches for Lower Merion basketball team, they get buses of Chinese fans visiting the high school every summer. Just take photos.
Hey, look.
They make the pilgrimage all that way just to...
To each their own.
Yeah.
And I go, everyone knows I go to Croatia every summer. Dubrovnik, you get off the plane, not even into the city, and they're already trying to gouge you on Game of Thrones tours.
Oh.
Where it's like 150 euros, and all they do is walk you around the city like, oh, those are the stairs where Cersei did the Walk of Shame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They look like stairs from the show. Oh, that corridor that looks like 100 other corridors in the city is like... Where Varys had a conversation with somebody one time, and everyone's like, oh, great, this 150 euros really well spent for me.
So you're not going to feel any kind of way during Game 7 of Philly-Toronto that it's the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones going on simultaneously?
So I watched the first three. I binged Game of Thrones like 4 summers ago, watched the first 3.5 seasons and bailed, which is unlike me. And I just was like, it's a B. It's a B, and I don't have time for a B. So I bailed.
Okay.
There were too many characters I didn't care about, and my wife can't watch it because it's gory in every single episode. The Ramsay, Ramsay, I'm like, can we just have enough of Ramsay really torturing people? Yeah. This poor Theon. And then last summer, whenever the most recent season before this one was on, I think it was last summer.
It was.
I would wake up in the mornings in Croatia with nothing to do. I would wake up before everybody else, and I just watched them online to get back into it. And I was like, okay, now I've seen enough. And then I rewatched a little bit of like the missing 4 and 5 seasons where the Martell dude gets his head smushed, mm-hmm. and like some other stuff happens. So like I feel Dorne is involved. I don't really know what Dorne is or who the sand snakes really are, but I saw a little bit of that.
I wasn't a big fan of that.
Nobody appears to have been a fan of the sand snakes. So when this season came, I was like, all right, I want to be part of the moment. I'll fake it. So I missed the last episode. I didn't see that one.
Okay.
I was in Boston. I had some meetings that night. I met a source at a bar that was having a Game of Thrones watch party. Oh. We walked in. They were like, you can't talk. No talking. I was like, this is a bar. I want to talk.
Yeah.
So I saw the very end of that one. So I will not feel. Okay. There's two left or three? Two. You said penalty. Two left. Yeah.
Like I've had. Been fortunately covering these Philly games. I've watched it with my brother and his wife, like, I don't know, all but one of the episodes. And the other episode I watched with one of my buddies, Cabbies in the Toronto media. I'm going to miss it. And so I'm about to like pull the Rachel Nichols move and like mute every single word.
See, I don't care. Spoilers is, you have to take extreme measures. People can't complain about spoilers anymore. You can't be on Twitter.
I wouldn't complain about it, but you can try to protect yourself from it.
So spoiler alert. If the Night King only wants to kill Bran, and by the way, Bran is one of the characters, every time Bran was on the show, I don't really know what the Three-Eyed Raven is or who the Children of the Four. I missed all that. Anytime The Wall was on, I was like, get me off The Wall. The Wall sucks. If the Night King wanted to kill Bran, why did he send all the zombies at Winterfell and like six dudes at Bran? What's the point? What value does Winterfell have for
final dramatic walk with none of his bodyguards joining in on him?
I can't, like, I guess if you take Winterfell or whatever, like, does he doesn't care about living in a castle. I guess if you kill everyone, then you get more people in your army because the dead people fight for you. But it just feels like if you want to kill Bran, six dudes with bows and arrows should not really be a workable defense for Bran.
Also, when he dies, why does all the other White Walkers die?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't really make sense to me.
And also, the dragons suck. The dragons are awful. The dragon, there's two of them are dead.
Yeah.
Or one, I don't know. Is the other one, is the dead, is the White Walker one?
We don't know. Well, the White Walker one's
gone. That's dead.
And then.
Oh, he died. He dies because the Night King dies.
They all.
So that counts for him too.
Yeah.
This one fell into the water.
Fell into the water. I'm not convinced that it's dead because.
Well, the last one better bring it and burn everybody to death. Otherwise, I just don't really care about the dragons.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. As we're talking about this, it's kind of a B show. Like my like standard for shows, you know, Mad Men is probably my favorite of all time.
If
I
you
get
watch
a lot more out of Mad Men than I do, but Mad Men didn't have watch parties and like the shared experience.
No, it's
I really
cool.
enjoyed
Breaking
the shared
Bad. Breaking Bad got to the shared experience. Yeah. Breaking Bad bridged the gap of like this is actually super high quality and dense, and also got the shared experience. Mad Men was like a niche, really was a niche show. It was awesome, but it was a niche show. If you watched an episode of Mad Men and an episode of Game of Thrones, you'd be like, oh, one of these is way better than the other one. Anyway, I hope Sansa wins the throne.
Yeah.
She's the best. She's gone through a lot.
She has.
Some of the stuff I didn't see. I like the Starks. I want to roll with the Starks till the end. I want Sansa to win. That's it. That's the end of my Game of Thrones.
I'll take Jon Snow.
I just don't care. I've never cared. I don't care. Why do people like Jon Snow so much?
He's noble. It's a good quality.
Would you like to have a beer with Jon Snow?
No, but I that was like the problem of the presidential election when George W. won. Would you like to have a beer with George W.? Yeah, I'd rather have a beer with him than Al Gore.
Okay, but one of those things affects my life, and one of them is a fictional television show.
I understand, but if we're...
Okay, so your point is
in the realm, I would want someone like him.
That's fair. Anyway, that's fair. I can't argue with that. How about Sam? Can Sam be the king?
Yeah, I like Sam.
King Sam. That guy gets it.
Yeah, he
does a lot of research.
Yeah.
If you were a basketball writer, you'd be watching a lot of film.
He would be on your, a frequent guest.
Make a prediction for game 7. Who wins? Oh,
man. So I picked Philly in 6, and I don't want to be a prisoner of a previous prediction, but since we're going to make another prediction, I'll stick with Philly. Why not? I think they have more talent. And overall, that's, I don't know, that's iffy. But I actually think Joel Embiid's the best player in the series when he's right.
Over Kawhi.
And Kawhi's so good. But Joel just does things that they have no answer for when he's right. And when Kawhi is right, Philly has a little bit of an answer. Not Kawhi's still going to get his, but like, it's like Joel's the dragon.
I hope he's better than these other dragons. I picked Toronto in 6, so I'm already wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to wimp out and pick Toronto in 7 just because they're at home. I think Philly has a real chance. There's something gnawing in my gut. I actually told one of Philly's front office people who asked me before the game, I said, what do you think is going to happen? I said, my gut is you win tonight, and then my gut is a little confused about game 7. But there's something gnawing in my gut. Like, Philly's a hungry team, and it's just the first quarter is going to be telling because if Philly can get out to a lead, I think they're going to – they have a little bit of – I don't mean this in a bad way, but they puff their shoulders a little bit when they start to get a lead there and get out in front.
A little bit, yeah.
It'll be telling, but I'll go Toronto in 7. You want to talk about the other series that's going 7?
Yeah. The series that
– Oh, I forgot my important question.
Oh,
is
sure.
a Philly native?
Okay.
Where does the city stand on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Sixers? the song.
Big fans.
It is the best.
Big fans.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, I'm on a text chain with some of my high school buddies, and they will send that YouTube link to the song.
I get like when they start playing it after they win.
Oh, dude! So
I
want to
start like high fiving people.
They start playing it with like, you know, there's still 15, 16 seconds left in the game, and then they start pumping it in through the PA system. Yeah. And so by the time the final buzzer sounds, it's full blast. The PA announcers, you know, announcing the win, and the media seats in Philly actually like are behind the basket, and there's a bit of like a. There's a stairwell that's kind of gradual as it goes up. It's not very steep stairwell. So you see kind of the crowd and because they're easy, long steps to go up, like people are literally dancing up that stairwell often after the game and high five and everything. Like it's great.
It threads the needle where it's campy and somehow cool.
Yeah.
Like One Shining Moment is just campy. There's nothing cool about it.
I love
One, it, two, three, yes. Four, five, Sixers is awesome.
Right.
Like I get a little buzz when that comes on, even though it's literally just a dude counting and saying, here they come.
Yeah. That's the whole song. Stop your feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stop your feet. Yeah. Philadelphia. It's not a great song is what I'm saying, but it's awesome.
It reminds me of the Boogie Nights theme song, actually.
I don't remember that.
Someday, look it up.
I watched Boogie Nights many years ago.
Same era type of music.
I feel like a salesman for Denver, Portland, because it's the great unwatched series. Nobody thinks they have any chance to win in the next round, no matter who advances out of Golden State, Houston. It's been a really, really fun series. Jokic is tearing it up. Jamal Murray has had an up and down, but mostly a very good series. Dame finally got into a rhythm last night and started being like Logo Lillard.
My boy Rodney Hood, don't put me back into a blowout win over Toronto.
So wasn't there some disputing about whether that was actually true? Somebody came out with a story this week that like somehow disputed whether that was a thing. And it's rare that you get like a year later people trying to rewrite what happened.
You understood
that was the thing. That wasn't your story originally,
no,
I don't think.
No, it was Jason Lloyd's story originally. But I'm pretty sure Rodney Hood ended up apologizing for it at the time.
I'd have to go back.
His actions. So
you know what? He did. He did.
Yeah, he did.
I think I saw some reporting trying to.
Okay. But it's remarkable to see, you know, when you cover a team, you get somewhat intimately close to these guys and you know them in a certain capacity. And so, you know, George Hill was very up and down. And now you see he has this nice little runway in Milwaukee and making big plays and big moments. And, you know, Rodney Hood, of course, the four overtime game, but it wasn't just a flash in the pan. I mean, he was really good in game six as well.
You asked for, like, what's a good post-up stat and stuff. Mm-hmm. Rodney Hood is the best isolation player in the whole playoffs right now. I'm sorry. Marcus Morris is a tick over him.
Okay.
He's averaging like 1.4 points per possession. It's like outrageous. He's destroying everybody that Denver throws at him because Denver has all these little guards.
Yeah.
And last night when he started to get rolling, and I think we will maybe see this in game seven, they actually flipped the matchups and put Paul Millsap on him and put somebody else on a smaller guy on Evan Turner. Forget Evan Turner. We don't care. I think we might, if he keeps rolling, I think they're going to have to look at doing that. And he's had, as you said, he's gone through some pretty open confidence issues and it's been fun to see. Neil Olshey gave up Sauce Castillo, who was at the game last night.
Yeah.
In Philly. Wade Baldwin, who nobody really is interested in having on their team right now, and 2 second round picks for Rodney Hood. Now 2 second round picks, 2021 and 2023. Portland, if Dame is there, will probably be still pretty good then, but you never know. That's like a real price. Rodney Hood has changed the series. Like, this series is over, if not for Rodney Hood.
Absolutely.
And you wouldn't have guessed that from what happened with
certainly
Cleveland.
Not. He did have, and since it was a sweep, I want to get the right game. I think it was game three of the finals. He, after a very quiet, and that's putting it mildly, postseason last year for Cleveland, he came out and looked like a player, and it was like, okay, good for you. You put yourself in the right mental space to be able to perform with all this pressure. Of course, KD had the recreation of the wing shot, and you go up 3-0, and you don't really want to talk about Rodney Hood after that. You want to talk about how the Warriors are about to spank the Cavs again. But then he came into the season. I think there was, you know, some stories by like people like Chris Fedor and Joe Varden about – you know, he had refocused himself and he's ready to, you know, take these minutes in Cleveland. And it really wasn't happening in Cleveland, though.
Well, and in Utah, he was the heir apparent to Gordon Hayward for a hot second. And then Donovan Mitchell, it came and mm-hmm. immediately seized control of the team. And Rodney Hood just kind of quaked a little bit and couldn't figure it out. And when they traded Hood for Crowder, it felt like selling a little low on Hood, but Crowder really helped Utah and Hood just vanished. And then it was like, well, Utah just, they knew what they were doing. Yeah. Great trade. And now it's like, okay, Rodney Hood has found something in the water is right in Portland. Now, win or lose game seven, to get this far without Nurkic, who was, and I've said this before and people think I'm crazy, who was their second best player this season. He was better than CJ this season. CJ has been fantastic and the playoffs have been fantastic. To get this far is a real achievement. And it's not a coincidence that a guy like Rodney Hood goes into that culture with a great coach, a GM that has fostered a really good culture, and one of the great leaders in all of sports in Damian Lillard, and is suddenly good again. It's not a coincidence.
So you remember how the, I guess it was Dame and CJ on social media were kind of trying to get Melo's attention last summer.
Yeah.
He was trying to pick a team. Rodney's kind of playing the role to some extent that Melo would have been playing had he come there, which is just funny to think about that. Now, you know, Melo's posting photos on Instagram of him still working out and trying to wait for that next opportunity.
Yeah. I've never been a huge Melo guy. I've always thought he was overrated. I still want to see him play again. It just can't, end like this.
Yeah.
It can't end like this.
But just interesting that, like, obviously not apples to apples, but he's kind of taking the minutes and the shots that Melo feasibly could have had.
Game seven of that one, that's a shoulder shrug, because I picked Portland to win the series, so I guess I should technically pick Portland. Game seven, home teams almost always win. That's a
Denver did have the best home record in the league this year, I think.
Either them or Milwaukee. I can't remember. They were the two best teams. And that's why, and Denver has won borderline must win game fours, down 2-1 in San Antonio and in Portland. They had the tied for the third best home record in the league. Like, those are, say what you want about Denver and their soft-ish road to the conference finals. Those are balls out wins.
Absolutely.
Like, you beat those teams in game four on the road. I don't care if the Spurs are and Portland is missing. Those are quality wins. The thing that's going to be really interesting in Game 7 is how long the key guys can go. Because Denver, other than Game 5, when they take Jokic out of the game, they're getting destroyed. And they've had Millsap as the only starter on the floor with a bunch of their bench guys. Now, Will Barton used to be a starter, but you can count him as a starter mm-hmm. if you want. Those lineups have not been good. They were good in game five. They were bad again last night. Then they bring Jamal Murray in to start the fourth quarter as a second starter with those lineups. That is something I think they're going to have to do. I don't know if they can roll those lineups out again in game seven. And it's just going to be a matter of, do Barton and Beasley make shots? And if they don't, I could see Harris, who's been really good, and Murray and Jokic and Millsap playing like 45 minutes apiece. This is just good or bad. Like, this is when you just lay it all out. And that's why game seven is fun. It's like, if Jokic has to play the whole set, the dude played 65 minutes already.
It was incredible. And his coach apologized to him for it. But I mean, obviously, and he was in that game, he was that. But if it is like a game seven where, let's say, intensity's ratcheted up just a little bit more and energy needed to be expended, ratcheted up a little bit more, can he really give you 45 effective minutes?
I don't know, but that's the kind of game. Maybe you try that lineup to start the second quarter and have a super quick hook on it. Mm-hmm. And again, if they make a couple, like Will Barton, you go under screens in game five. You made 2 threes, I think, out of that. If that happens, like, okay, you've now bought yourself another 2 minutes because you just went on a 6-0 run. I mean, sometimes it's that simple. And on the other side, Hood and Zach Collins, Hood's getting most of the attention. Zach Collins has been awesome, and they have kind of made up for the fact that Aminu and Harkless are not making shots. And they even played them a little bit together with the other three starters, which I think is an interesting look. And it's been a really fun series. And Dame, they can't, Denver, Jokic just isn't good enough to when Portland runs its best stuff, you know, when they set a pick one way for Dame, Jokic can keep up. When they flip it back and make a second pick out of it, Jokic is done. He's below the 3-point line. And Dame's just either not taking those shots or missed them. And last night he started making them. And he and CJ, who's been cooking for most of the series there, one of them's going to have a big game. Yeah. Sometimes it just comes down to, you know, does he make those shots or not? And I think if Portland is diligent about running their best stuff, you know, double screens, double drag screens for Dame in transition, those rescreen actions, like he's going to get open shots. The book is closed on that. He's going to get open shots and he's just got to make them.
So one of these teams is going to be Western Conference finalists. The other one's going to be one game away from being Western Conference finalists. So you would say going into next season that they would look pretty good. And mm-hmm. but would you consider either of them to be like a straight up contender going into next year, or like is there some major adjustment outside of just getting Nurkic back for Portland that would need to occur for to make you think that they would? And I know, you know, Durant and Kyrie, all these guys can move around, but just like outside of that.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why these Warriors games, or game, however many games there are without KD, are going to be so interesting, because I think there's just been sort of an assumption that, like, if KD leaves, they're the number one seed in the West again next year. And I don't think that's true.
I'm with
because
you.
This isn't like Harrison Barnes is gone. Sean Livingston is about to be gone. Andre Iguodala is 35. Steph is 31. Steph's not getting separation as easily in this series. Even the shots he made the other night after KD went out, unless he got Capella on a switch, he didn't open up space against like Austin Rivers and Eric Gordon. He used to be able to open up space against anybody and he hasn't been able to do that. Draymond's almost 30. They have no, if they re-sign those guys, if they re-sign Clay, they have no cap space to get anybody. Mm-hmm. Now they'll get, you know, ring chasers will come, whatever. Now, whether these are the teams that rise up in the vacuum or whatever vacuum and challenge them. But yeah, I mean, I think Denver is young and improving. My guess is Millsap will be back there next year. He's been just brutalizing everybody.
Yeah.
Nurkic comes back. Portland still feels like a player away. Like Aminu and Harkless, it's just not going to happen. They're not going to pop into anything better than they are. Aminu is a sneaky free agent, by the way. He's good, despite having a shooting slump in the series. He's mm-hmm. good. That's why, to me, and I might write about this for tomorrow, Zach Collins is a really interesting player, because I think in the future he's a center, but he's good enough to play around Nurkic and Kanter. If he can, and he's starting to pop a little bit, that changes their... Now, he was a 10th pick. Like he's
sure
should be good. That changes their life a little bit. I mean, who else is there in the West? The Thunder, we just, you know, they're going to be in the picture. The Rockets, I think, would enter the season next year as favorites. If KD leaves.
And the Lakers could, who knows? They could look different next year.
Well, I mean, if Kurt Rambis is the coach and they run the triangle, you know, we'll see what happens. Yeah, is there any, so is Ty Lue just not?
Oh, Clippers too.
Yep. Oh yeah, well yeah, the Clippers right, again. These sure, are these sure, are yeah, the sort of like
stuff that can move
musical
around.
Chairs yeah, teams, right?
Ty Lue.
So he's just not going to be the coach.
I'm not convinced that it's completely dead. There could be a Jon Snow back to life scenario. Bring back.
See, Gareth I missed Reynolds. That. Well, that season, I don't really yeah. know what happened.
Well, that's again part of the reason that I have a problem with the show. You can't just kill the main character. Like, bring him back to life, you know.
But that's how they got famous, by killing what everyone thought was going to be the main character.
Yeah, right.
Ned Stark.
Oh, very true. But I do think though that it's not in a good space right now at all. And you're just starting to hear things, you know, about perhaps why Ty wasn't the perfect candidate. Well, listen, he was offered the job. You made it a millions and millions of dollar commitment to have him be your head coach. So, you know, for instance, that you hear some things that like maybe Ty wasn't so specific with his scouting reports to the young players in the interview process. And that's why the Lakers were interested in pairing him with Jason Kidd, because, you know, Jason Kidd, I guess, had a player development plan for the younger players. You talk to people familiar with Ty's view of these things, and it was, well, all I got was positive feedback about how great things went in the interviews, and I didn't have to go to the next step of my presentation, which was literally having a 3-page scouting report prepared on every single player on the Lakers roster from last year. Like, Ty's the type of guy who has, like, binders. Like, as I talk to you, I respect that you got a 3-ring.
I bought.
What do you even call this?
This is a single one subject notebook.
Yeah,
I bought 2 of these from Dwayne Reed the other day, and my wife saw them and she's like, "What are you doing? Why do you have these in our house?" I'm like, "I'm an old man. I need to have
written out notes." And that's Ty Lue's style as well. And so it's just funny. So you hear this kind of posturing, right? Of the information that gets out there, and when you get to that stage, it makes me wonder if it could be repaired. But at the same time, LeBron James, to me, is the most important employee they have in that company. And we still haven't heard from him. And I feel like if he wanted to make a play publicly or something like that for Ty Lue, I think that could change the game. Now, he traditionally hasn't done that. He's someone who kind of works in the margins. So
LeBron is incredible at plausible deniability.
Absolutely.
He is incredible at being like, I never asked anyone to do anything or for input on this and that, but I'm also like going to be perturbed if it goes badly. But also it's incredible how he does that.
Right. So again, that would be a break from his normal manner, but I mean, this isn't a normal situation. He has a couple years left in his career. And so, does he want it to go in a way that he would trust it in that person's hands or not? And so that's why I still think there would be a chance of it getting back to being resuscitated. But I could also certainly see a pairing of your next head coach is Jason Kidd alongside Frank Vogel. Your next head coach is Frank Vogel alongside Jason Kidd or some combination of that.
That will draw more protests at the Staples Center. although I will say this, you know, the young players thing, I don't know how prepared Ty was or not. I've not talked to him or anybody about it. For all the flack Jason Kidd took in Milwaukee, and I think a lot of it was deserved, the schemes were bad at the end, teams had figured them out, relationships had gotten frayed. The young players who are now, not the young players anymore, the core guys on the team, even if they had misgivings about Jason at the end, all of them say, unprompted, you don't ask them, like, the guy really taught us about winning and how hard we would have to play and what, and that if we win, everybody is going to get rewarded. Don't worry about your touches. If we win, like, it's not a smokescreen. They have no reason to protect him anymore. He's not there. They will tell you unprompted, like, yeah, you know, look, there were some things that went sideways, this and that, but like the mentality he instilled in us about what mattered, how hard you had to play and what winning would mean to each of us as individuals, like that made an impact on them for better or worse. Better, I think.
Right. And I think another reason he gets killed or his public perception is really bad right now is that it looked like he was never just interested in coaching. He wanted to have the front office piece in Brooklyn and in Milwaukee. From my understanding, you know, there's certainly some truth to that. But it was also situational. Maybe in Brooklyn, it was about like kill or be killed and seeing things shifting with Billy King and wanting to position himself the right way. And then in Milwaukee, he comes in as a hand selection of the ownership. And so that already puts him in, you know, a different kind of org chart because it's not being hired by the front office. And so I don't believe that if he comes to LA and ends up being on the coaching staff or the head coach of this team, that will be an issue. I don't think he's going to be trying to overreach and become the team president or anything like that.
It's hard to overreach LeBron. It's just hard to, he's the most powerful person, no matter where he is. Enough Lakers. Denver, Portland's going to be awesome. Sunday's going to be awesome.
What are you picking in that? You're sticking with Portland.
I mean, I guess I'm bound to a Portland prediction, but I would think the home team will win. Dame looked great in game 6. That was an eye opener because I thought he looked tired for most of the series. So maybe I expect a good game. But Denver's been great at home. Role players always play better at home. I will say one thing. Portland, in game five, put Aminu on Jokic, which is something I wrote about before game five, and I wrote that it would not work. And it did not work, and it was a disaster. Jokic just ran him over, and I was shocked. And so they had Kanter on Millsap.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked that they started game six the same way, and Jokic destroyed him again, and they were down 16-7 with 6.5 minutes left in the first quarter, and Terry Stotts finally threw up the white flag. And, you know, credit him for being like, it's not working. Like, I'm, the theory behind it is interesting, but it's not working. And I don't think we'll ever see it again, and it's good they got that out of the system in game six. They won't mess around with it in game seven. I highly doubt it. And it's good that Dame found his jump shot again, because he was shooting below 30% from three, I think. So there were some things that happened in game six that feel like they will carry a little bit into game seven. So I'm expecting a barn burner, but I will stick with my Denver. I will stick with the home team. I think the home team usually wins. So
yeah, that's a good pick. Just quick though, Kanter, what do they do with him now? I mean, this off season, he's obviously done great for them.
Yeah, I got to eat some crow on Kanter. He has come a long way from can't play Kanter. Now, he's in the wrong matchup. He still can't play. Defensively, he is what he is. Well, he's playing very hard. But my God, that dude is tough as hell because he's hurt. He's clearly hurt. He dunked in game one or two and hurt his shoulder again by just dunking. And he is toughing it out. And Jokic is not fun to play against when you have a hurt shoulder.
Well, you saw the clip, right? They're both lined up at the free throw line.
Yeah.
In rebound position, and the shot goes up and Jokic just like barges low, or I guess crouches down low and just barges his shoulder right into Kanter's bum shoulder. Like it's definitely dirty.
It hurts.
But also, like, it wasn't like a foul or anything like that. Yeah. It's just like,
it's how big guys play.
Yeah, exactly.
It depends, I guess, what their prognosis for Nurkic is, because if they have Nurkic and Collins, I don't know how much they're going to need to spend money on Kanter, and they have a lot of money on the books already. Myers Leonard is still there.
But good for him though. Like he earned himself a pretty good deal this summer.
He earned himself a good deal. He earned a lot of people's respect. I was really hard on him. I think he's a train wreck on defense, but he's played hard in this series, and like, you can never question his toughness again. The guy is absolutely gutting it out, and total all credit to him. They don't get here without him. Just like they don't get here without Hood, they do not get here without him.
Nope.
They might not win the first round without good minutes from him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they won that series 4-1. On one of the greatest shots of all time. I mean, my God, it's still so thinking great. About that shot. It's
love it.
I can't believe the dude made that shot.
It's making me smile. Like, I have a full-on smile right now.
It was crazy.
It's just one of those moments. Like, it's what makes the NBA great.
He's made two of them already. Mm-hmm. Two walk-off playoff series shots. I mean, that's like, when he makes the Hall of Fame, that's going to be one of the reasons why. He's made iconic shots. And he's going to make the Hall of Fame if he plays 6-7 more years like this. There's no question.
And I don't want to be like over the top, because it wasn't championship winning or anything, but like, they're both like, I know where I was when moments for
me.
Like, now the other one just happened, so we should remember it, but the one he hit against Houston, like, I was covering the Spurs Dallas first round series in 2014, and I'm in the media room in Dallas, and I'm trying to write, and I hear people like, you know, last possession, you come out, and like, we're all just like glued to the television, and a walk-off game winner to end the series.
I'm ashamed to say that I don't. Actually, I think I was just home.
Okay.
When that, I don't think I was anywhere interesting. Isn't that playoff series, the inexplicable 7-game series between San Antonio and Dallas?
Yes.
When San Antonio rolls to the title, and yet somehow Dallas takes them to 7 games in the first round.
Monte Ellis was giving them problems.
Vince hit a huge corner three in that series.
Yeah.
DeJuan Blair did some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the more random, like, this is going 7, really?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Okay. Credit to the Mavs. I guess they got rolled, and I'm looking at game 7, 119-96.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you got to actually go do your job. Dave McMenamin has been covering, as I said, you have 4 different beats that are all on fire right now, so good luck with that.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for making a little time, and thanks, I won't see you in Toronto for game 7, but who knows?
Hopefully conference finals or beyond.
Who knows? I don't know. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.